I'm Brian Park.
I'm Matt Ruiz.
And welcome to the second episode of Season 3 of ACM AI's You Belong in AI podcast, presented by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. You Belong in AI interviews inspiring individuals in the AI community about their background and their thoughts on the importance of representation and diversity in AI. Today, I want to welcome our fellow Bruin, Kitu Komya. Kitu received her bachelor's degree in statistics at UCLA in 2018. Kitu is currently a machine learning engineer at O'Reilly Media. Previously, she was a research intern at various groups, including Infosys and the National Institutes of Health. In her free time, she's also an amazing hip-hop dancer, violinist, writer, and spicy Thai curry enthusiast. Kitu, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so our first segment, before we dive into your AI career, is going to be about your education and background. So our first question for that is basically, what were you like growing up? What were you interested in both academically and non-academically throughout grade school?
Sure, yeah. So I was raised in Michigan, and I was raised by immigrant parents who really valued education and really carved the support system I needed to make it my priority. So I was always very academically inclined. I was actually really focused on the life sciences track, and everyone around me in Michigan was trying to be a doctor, and that's kind of where I was headed to. I competed in a lot of science Olympiad competitions and was really on that trajectory of trying to be a doctor. Outside of academics, I was really quiet. I really liked arts and crafts, writing, reading. I'd bring like my Harry Potter books to family parties. Inventing like games with friends was pretty imaginative, and then playing violin as well. So nothing really pointed me toward tech when I was growing up, mostly because the people I was around did not really have kind of the same support system as tech. It was more kind of medical life sciences driven.
Awesome. That's really interesting. And that brings me to our next question, which is, so I saw that you went into UCLA as a stats major, and growing up, you mentioned that you're really into the medical field. What led you to shift away from those areas and specialize in computer science and machine learning? Was there like a specific moment or story that made you realize that machine learning or computer science was better suited for you?
Yeah, this is a really cool question. I think it also implies that statistics is a little different than machine learning, when statistics actually is the foundation. But before I kind of go into that, I wanted to share how I even pivoted into the data science realm, since I mentioned I came from a life science medical path. So I was a student in pre-med for about 2 years in college, but I realized I didn't actually like what I was doing. I was good at it, but I didn't actually enjoy it. I even like shadowed a doctor and was not really a huge fan of the kind of work life I would have. So I was looking for a new career path. I felt that like if I was not 110% committed on being a doctor, I probably should not be a doctor. At the time I was working at a research lab, a wet lab, where I was wearing all the PPE, like the white lab coat, goggles, gloves, and extracting human DNA and RNA from blood samples and putting in how much quantity and quality was coming from those test tubes manually into an Excel spreadsheet. So I'd been doing that for about a year and a half. I asked one of my lab mates, like, what happens to all the data that I'm collecting? Does anyone do anything with it, or is it just sitting in the spreadsheet? A lab mate told me all about data analysis and how the end stream of what I'm doing is actually getting analyzed to actually understand like associations between different diseases using RNA and blood samples. And I was incredibly enthused by that because I wanted to do something that was impactful at a more global level and not just manually doing test tube extractions one at a time. So I spent a lot of time going to as many workshops as I could, a lot of ACM workshops, a lot of statistics and math workshops to see like what data science is really all about. I'd read as much as I could online. I was also pressed for time since I only had about like half a semester before my second year was out. So I tried out a lot of majors, from like applied math to computational systems bio to biophysics and bioengineering. And statistics was kind of there, but I wasn't really sure what it was going to be like. But when I discovered data science through like talking to a lot of people as well as reading online, I really thought that was the path forward. I went to a math event actually, and I talked to an industry leader in data science, and I asked him to kind of just confirm me, like, you're probably using a lot of applied math at your job, correct? And he actually surprised me and said that statistics is what he uses on his day-to-day. So that's actually when I was more aware of statistics being a larger part of data science. So I quickly switched over my major to statistics. And then I read more online that to stay qualified data scientists, staying at like the crossroads of computer science and statistics really is the best of both worlds. So my goal was to be the best statistician in all of my computer science classes and also the best programmer among my statistics peers. So that really fared pretty well for me to stay at that intersection and be much more involved in the data science of that. So that's kind of my path to data science and what kind of made me want to focus more on computer science and statistics and machine learning.
Awesome. That's super cool how you found like an intersection between the medical field and data science, and then you kind of shifted towards the other side of that. My next question is, how was it transitioning from your hometown near Michigan to UCLA in Los Angeles? Did you have any difficulty with culture shock, with the location or demographic change? And how did you handle it, if so?
Yeah, thanks for asking this question. Michigan was a pretty big part of my childhood growing up, of course, so I think it's nice to give it credit. I was really excited at first going from Michigan to Los Angeles because it was a chance to really reinvent myself in a city far away. I was like excited to escape the small town feel, but I didn't realize how difficult it would be. I did not know anyone in Los Angeles, so it was pretty isolating at first. I had a really good stable routine in Michigan where I had like rehearsals for violin on Sunday, like science Olympiad and forensics competitions throughout the weekday. So I was really in the mind space of a routine where I saw familiar faces, and it was really difficult for me to mentally be in Los Angeles. And especially when I was in California, pre-med was really all I knew and everything I had done. So it was difficult for me to try to reinvent myself. But I learned to embrace Los Angeles pretty fast. I actually felt much more at home in Los Angeles in a way I wouldn't have expected. As a person of color, I never really felt belonged in Michigan, which is like a very super white majority state. And like for the first time, I actually felt that I also belong here and that I'm not any less American because I don't know any like classical American music. And I didn't really stick out like a sore thumb. So it actually did really well for me in terms of like diversity and belonging. Weather-wise, I cannot complain. I was so happy to escape the harsh winters and the snowstorms and blizzards from Michigan, so I can't complain. And there were just so many opportunities all around that I still to this day take advantage of. Growing up, like American Idol was a huge part of my childhood. I got to be on the set for that and The Voice and like see people like J-Lo, Ariana Grande, Bryan Cranston, Keith Urban, people who I would never even imagine in Michigan that I could even see. So I still kind of carry that like same awe with me that I think some native Californians take for granted, like how gorgeous the hills and the fauna are, how like the entertainment industry is right there, how great the food is. I became a spicy Thai curry enthusiast in college because I had so much more food options accessible to me that I did not have in Michigan. So I became like a very different person, much more extroverted, much more laid back, much more like open to different opportunities, different experiences, and also like eventually change and pursue an entirely different career. So it was really cool. I've really enjoyed reinventing myself in the process, but sometimes it feels like such a far away land that I forget that this is my new reality.
So I'm really glad that you adapted well to Los Angeles. So our last question for this segment is, did you run into any obstacles or feel underrepresented as a female minority in a predominantly male major / field like computer science?
This is a cool question because interestingly, I went to a math and science magnet school in high school where there was a lot of promotion for equal representation for females in tech. So at that time in high school, I didn't feel that I could not do it. But at that time, I was more focused on pursuing the pre-med track. And I was also much more creative inclined. And I didn't see that I was as aligned technically as some of the CS people. And when I was a stats major as well, the class was also mostly females, and male ratio was great. I think my experience would have been different if I was a CS or math major, however. And when I did attend some of like the CS events, sometimes I would feel like I'm sticking out and not that this is my path for me. But what really stuck more for me was less my gender and more my capabilities, I saw myself more creative and less logical and didn't really see a way forward for me in CS. And when I joined industry, however, I saw the ratio much more emphasized and the weight was much more evident. So I was glad that like in college and high school, I didn't feel that, but in industry, I could definitely see how minorities and females, everything was really stacked up against them, from the job post to hiring to interviews, to interview panels, to even like my actual team makeup. I've always been usually like the only female in AI on my team. So there is like this internal pressure maybe I put on myself to prove that yes, I'm a woman and yes, I'm intelligent and professional. I've had to like fake confidence and make my voice deeper and only really like ask for help when I've thoroughly done my research, because I don't want to add to the bias that women are less capable than men, because they can be much more harshly evaluated and scrutinized because it's so much more rare to see a woman in the field. So it was much more of a stark contrast when I actually entered industry than it was for me personally in my classes, but that's also because I pursued statistics and not a more heavily male dominated field like computer science or math.
I see. That's a really good answer. Thank you. That wraps it up for our first segment. So now I will pass it on to Matt.
We'll be transitioning to more of your professional life at O'Reilly. So right after college, you were brought in as the first founding machine learning engineer at O'Reilly. Can you explain what O'Reilly is and how you got hired and how did they pitch the position to you?
Sure, yeah. So O'Reilly Media is a learning platform. They also write a lot of technical books, the ones with the animals on it. They also have a learning platform where you can browse and read lots of books, videos, case studies, and such. How this position fell into my lap is actually very serendipitous and not something I was seeking intentionally. So because I had a more statistics background, also had dabbled in computer science classes in college, I was actually aiming to become a data scientist, but it was really difficult, if not nearly impossible, to break through the data science field with just a bachelor's, even if I was qualified. I had multiple loops with startups at the final round where I was told that they really liked me, but they would end up choosing someone with industry experience. So then I expanded my search more broadly from like analyst all the way to engineer. And I noticed really quickly that for every 10 engineering positions I would apply, I would actually hear back from at least one. In contrast, it was probably closer to nearly 100 to hear back from one data science role. So I was more willing to explore software engineering, but I was also really bad at LeetCode and was not my primary skill set. So when I learned about machine learning engineering just through my job search, I really became a fan of being able to combine both my computer science and data science skills. So I was really excited when I saw that role. I was told to do a take-home assessment and they liked me. They liked how I kind of thought through my approach and was able to answer like algorithmic questions as well. And they liked what I would be bringing to the team. How it was pitched to me was that it would be a role in which I would constantly be learning new technologies. And I told them that I was totally okay with that, which I was. So it was a very interesting route and I'm glad that it ended up in my lap, but it was not something I would have known otherwise, because it was not a role that I had even learned about when I was looking for jobs.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned how you're just dabbling between data science and maybe even like software engineering. And that kind of leads me to my next question. Can you kind of like describe the difference between like a machine learning engineer and a software engineer? Maybe like the daily roles or kind of like what to expect?
Yeah, for sure. So the definition of a machine learning engineer does vary widely job title to job title, but what's always true is that it's always a type of software engineer. Software engineer is an umbrella term. There can be a front-end software engineer, mobile infrastructure, back-end, and then also machine learning engineer. So it's primarily a software engineering role with focus on machine learning. So it's someone who can build scalable software and code, but also knows machine learning and can work maybe with data pipelines or machine learning algorithms and put them into production. These are responsibilities that traditional software engineers don't have. So it ends up being someone kind of with jack of all trades, master of none, because they're at the intersection of so many skill sets. One difference in kind of the types of problems that machine learning versus software engineering solves is that in software engineering, the objectives are much more defined. You're going to like actually build out an infrastructure that will support some kind of ML algorithm. It's like measured by like a binary metric. Is the infrastructure built out or is it not? Solving problems with data, with AI and ML, it's usually a hypothesis. For instance, like if we were to add this automated fraud detection, will it improve fraud detection? We won't know until it's actually done. So it's kind of like betting on whether it'll work. Whereas software engineering, you're just building the fraud detection infrastructure and it's like measured much more concretely. The types of problems are also a bit more different. In machine learning AI, you really have to think of how you want to be using data. A lot of times such positions, they know they want to use data, but they don't know how to use data. And many times it's bottlenecked also by software engineers who can build the infrastructure. So there are a lot of data scientists who will have a lot of their codes rotting away in Jupyter Notebook and no one to really put them to production. That's kind of where the ML engineer role comes in, where it can kind of pull that forward. Also in machine learning AI, there's really no black and white metric. Sometimes you can build out a machine learning algorithm in which like there are multiple different conflicting metrics, like it'll increase engagement, but maybe like decrease revenue or something like that. So there's a lot of like trade-offs that you have to make with ML and AI, whereas software engineering is a bit more defined and concrete. So it's been pretty interesting, but still definitely a software engineering position where I'm helping to like build the infrastructure to put the models in production and not just sitting in some kind of notebook for no one to see.
Right. Then you kind of mentioning how machine learning engineering, it's not really concrete. And also in the last section, you mentioned how you like to express your creativity, like especially during your undergraduate. So that kind of leads me to my next questions. How are you able to express creativity as a machine learning engineer?
Oh, that's interesting. Because ML is little less defined and a bit more abstract, there's a lot of approaches you can take and there's not really one right way. So I kind of like to look at the problem at hand and kind of assess what is the problem we're actually trying to solve. It's different in school when you're doing like Kaggle competitions and you're just trying to see like what has the best model, but you have to understand like what is the bottom line of this like algorithm are you trying to make sure people are able to get more personalized recommendations, or are you trying to like reduce fraud detection? So it's a much more creative approach where you can approach it from different angles. You can look at different kind of data to use. It's up to you to decide like what kind of data you want to use. It's up to you to decide how you want to work with that data, how you want to transform it. It's up to you to decide what kind of models to use. It's up to you to see how you want to tune it. It's up to you to decide who to give that model to. So there's a lot of creativity and there's no one right answer. So it really helps me kind of exercise that creativity in a very technical capacity still.
Awesome. That's a very insightful answer. Then kind of like circling back to your role as a founding machine learning engineer, was it like intimidating being that first engineer at your company, and especially, you know, being fresh out of college and also being maybe underrepresented minority?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was challenging, equal parts rewarding as well. The most difficult part was that no one else at our company was doing the kind of work we were doing. What we were doing specifically was building a recommendation system from scratch using machine learning. All of the other engineering teams were much more focused on traditional software engineering. It was also difficult because coming from a bachelor's degree in statistics and computer science, I learned quickly that software in production is vastly different than the CS you learn in school. Scripts are not meant to be run just once. It's supposed to be an unbreakable production quality code where you're thinking about things like scalability, maintainability, flexible if you wanted to add new features, monitoring, test cases, alerting, modularity. Like there's a lot of tools to help with that, but it's a totally different framework of thinking than what I was exposed to in school. So it was definitely very challenging, but it was also equal parts rewarding because I helped build infrastructure entirely from scratch, and having the context like end to end was incredibly awesome because I was able to make smart decisions much more fast. And it also meant that because there were no silos, I could really have much more ownership and impact and really make decisions that would help the model become much more fast and much more efficient. So it was really exciting, but there was a lot of ramp up time because I came from like a less traditional background. It took me honestly about like 9 months to really get the hang of how to be writing good quality production code and how to be working with machine learning models in production and not just one-off script. So there's definitely a learning curve if you don't come from that background, but it's definitely doable and definitely possible. And for a role as exciting as ML engineering, where you're kind of wearing multiple hats as a data engineer, data scientist, software engineer, you get to dabble in a lot of different things, which is exciting. Also can be a little frustrating because you never feel like you know something really well, but it also kind of makes you stronger because you have a lens to see different viewpoints really well. And it's also really good for job security. Like, I'm not worried at all because I have skills across many different fields now.
That's really cool. Like you mentioned, you have so many different skills, you know, dabbling into so many different things. And also appreciate how you said that, like, even coming from your background, like, you know, it's very accessible to like just walk into this position. It does take time, like you said, like 9 months, but it's doable for anyone. So yeah, I appreciate that. So you mentioned how you have like complete ownership in your ML project. Can you kind of like describe the ML pipelines, you know, you built for your company and like how a user might like interact with that, like on a day-to-day basis on your website?
Yeah, for sure. So as I mentioned, O'Reilly is a learning platform where you can go to the homepage and look up as many books and videos that you want, but our catalog has thousands and thousands and thousands of books and videos. So we wanted to have a recommendations model that could actually point which ones might be more relevant. So there actually had been a recommendations module built before, but it was not powered using real-time machine learning. It was also very, very stale. It wouldn't update until like many days. It was also not personalized. Everyone's recommendations was Python, regardless of whether you were a Python person. So like product managers or designers, they would always get Python titles, even if they were not interacting with it. It was really outdated, and also it would not adapt to new users because they had no profile of it. So there was a lot of scope to kind of increase the dynamic recommendations. So we were kind of inspired by like Netflix and YouTube and how they know you so well and can recommend things in real time. So if you were searching something right away, it'll be able to give you a new set of recommendations. So the kind of work I did was across data engineering, machine learning, and software engineering. So when a user is searching around the platform, clicking around different book titles and viewing different books, there are front-end tracking events that are being sent into a data storage place. One of the things I did was build data pipelines from those tracking events so that I could build profiles for those users in real time. So I built like streaming and batch pipelines that could process that data and put it into another table that we would use for training. So once I had a lot of different pipelines built for the user side, as well as like the book sides of books or videos were getting updated, would have another pipeline to process that. If users were interacting, would have pipelines to process that. We'd have pipelines to process which contents were most popular as well. And then the data science part of it was pretty exciting to actually work on using the data and trying to define like what features might be useful in recommending a user. So we looked at things like user side, as well as like the book side. So profile demographics on the user, as well as like what the metadata on the content is like. So it was really nice to be able to choose which ones. We started with like a simple model, a logistic model, and then eventually went to more advanced ones like neural network models. And then eventually we were able to like deploy that to a cloud-based, and then there was a lot of infrastructure actually needed to support it. So my time on machine learning was much more short than I would have imagined. As a machine learning engineer, most of the time is spent building out the infrastructure and the software. So for instance, adding things like user authentication, like some users are only allowed to see certain types of books. So making sure that that is appropriate, adding like retry filters. So if the response is not returning anything, making sure there's a mechanism in place, adding like a lot of like software improvements, like caching and optimization and like reducing how much data set, and even building out like an A/B testing experiment framework just to make sure we can deploy to different subsets of people and kind of A/B test. So we built out an entire framework for that. And then eventually we automated the entire thing end to end so that we wouldn't have to manually trigger the pipeline, manually run a model, manually check if it's good, and manually deploy it. It was all automated so that we would even get alerted if it was wrong. So what we ended up doing helped triple the engagement rate. So originally there was only 4% click-through. By the end, it was 12% click-through. And then also the latency was hugely reduced. It used to take 5 seconds for the endpoint to be loaded. Afterward, it was 100 milliseconds. And the entire process was automated too. And it was a framework that could be extended for additional personalization problems. So it was really exciting to kind of build a general framework that could really like improve recommendations to make it much more personalized and much more fast and adaptive to users in real time. So really exciting to work on that.
Awesome. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of things that go into like being an ML engineer. And yeah, you mentioned like the data pipelines and like the software infrastructure that does take a lot of time. It's I myself didn't expect that to be like a majority of the time, but that's very interesting. And I guess like one last question for this section, when you're looking to hire ML engineers for a team, what are like the top like 3 or 5 skills that you look for?
Yeah, great question. So on the technical side, for the data side, I kind of understand how good are they with data and machine learning fundamentals. It's pretty easy to spot those who have a very flimsy understanding of how to work with data and those who have a very strong understanding of intuition and rationale on how to work with data. So kind of building that out by practicing on data problems and understanding when to use what type of feature engineering and when to use what type of model and really understanding the intuition of that. So that's something that is really easy to see through if someone is weak on that. On the software side, I try to see how clean, how easy to read, how maintainable their code is. Is this code that I would be able to extend features from easily? Is it modularized enough so that it can be unit tested properly? Is it robust and scalable? That's like thinking also about how it can be used over time. The soft skill side is equally as important, if not more. A lot of these technical skills can be taught, to be honest, but soft skills is something that you're kind of dealt with. So I really get a gauge of like how easy someone is to work with. Software engineering is much, much, much more collaborative than I had imagined. You work with a lot of different engineers on different tickets because everyone comes with different skill sets and everyone only has like a piece of the puzzle. So you kind of have to really work together much more often, communicate with each other. So kind of assess that kind of relationship. I also try to see like, what is their judgment like? Are they going to be looking out for the team or only for themselves? How good of a listener are they? Are they actually asking the question being asked? And just in general, like what kind of energy am I getting from you? Like, are they going to be empathetic and supportive and kind, or are they going to be arrogant and condescending and put themselves above the team? Because that is something that is really hard to backtrack from. And someone who's like able to take feedback well and not take it personally, able to have good rational discussion instead of being really defensive about it. So there's a lot of different dimensions, and I think it's kind of easier to get a sense of that once you interview different types of people. So focusing on both the soft skill side and technical sides, I think, are equally important.
Awesome, appreciate that answer. Okay, so that finishes up our section on professional life with O'Reilly. We're moving on to our next section called 10 Epochs. We're welcoming Kitu Komiya to 10 Epochs, our segment focused on 10 very pressing questions. Kitu is a former Bruin and currently works at O'Reilly as a machine learning engineer. Okay, we'll start with the first one. What is your favorite programming language?
I have to say R only because it was the first programming language that didn't intimidate me, but I feel like as like a software engineer, I should probably say something like Scala because it is very elegant and performant and clever, but I'm kind of toss up between the two.
R is definitely a first one. what's a bucket place you'd like to visit?
There is so many. It's kind of unfair to ask this question during a pandemic. So in America, the Glacier National Park in Montana is something I'd love to go to. Probably Japan, top of mind, outside of America.
Then what's a cooking or takeout?
For sure, Thai takeout. Honestly, I wish I was more of a gourmet chef who could cook because they liked cooking and not because they have to. Because I honestly can't play that to feed myself every single day for the rest of my life. So I will go with Thai cookout, takeout for now.
Awesome. Then what's your favorite childhood artist? Then also what's your current artist?
I was a big Lady Gaga fan growing up, but now I don't have one favorite artist. I just kind of have a lot of different interests across hip-hop, soul, R&B, and K-pop. So no one artist, but J-Hope is my BTS bias.
Cool. Then TensorFlow or PyTorch?
I haven't used PyTorch, but I know there's a lot of hate for TensorFlow. I think TensorFlow is dope, and honestly, its logo I think is so brilliant. I think it's really clever. So based on logo purposes, I'm going to go with TensorFlow.
I agree with the logo aspect as well. Then easy question, UCLA or USC?
Like, this is like a criminal question with two Bruins to ask one Bruin. So I'm going to have to, obviously, UCLA.
Awesome. Then what's your favorite emoji to use or like any emoji that you've made?
You definitely dug deep into my background. I've made like a lot of emojis in my past. I was like an emoji influencer. So there's really fun ones on slackmojis.com and blobs.gg. There's a lot of like funny panic ones where there's like animated panic. They look like they're troubled, but they're like really funny. There's like blob panic, mild panic, comfy panic. So definitely captures your state of mind in a way that like words cannot do. So those are some of my favorite emojis. So
then what's the favorite computer science related class you've taken?
I took algorithms, which is CS180 at UCLA by Professor Mecca. I really loved that. There were a lot of cool applications and just totally different way of like thinking about problems and learning how to optimize for it. So that one was definitely one of my favorites. Cool.
Then what's your favorite season of the year and why?
I like spring. Everything is pretty again. There's pretty flowers, there's pretty weather, pretty birds and everything. So definitely spring.
Awesome. Yeah, it's coming up. Then what's the coolest application or like research of AI you've seen recently?
I see a lot of healthcare applications, which I think is really exciting to see like AI for good. I saw like AI enabled prosthetics recently where the prosthetics can be controlled much more precisely. And more than that, it can help like patients actually feel objects, which is something that hasn't happened. So I'm really excited about that. I know there's like a lot of fear about like AI taking over. And I do think that some of those fears are substantiated. That's why we need more people on the front lines making ethical decisions. Some things that like keep me up at night are deep fakes and figuring out how to verify like authenticity or identity of a real person if you can just have video filters. So there's a lot of dark sides, but there's a lot of good sides in healthcare and agriculture and education to look out for as well.
Okay, that wraps up our section on 10 epochs. Thank you, Kito Kuma, for coming on. All right, I'm going to transition now to Brian to go over our next section.
Thank you, Matt. So our next segment will dive deeper into your other professional endeavors. So previously we talked about your experience working as an ML engineer at O'Reilly Media, and you also have background in ML research and academia in groups like Infosys and the National Institutes of Health. So could you describe the differences between the two in working as an engineer versus working in research, and what do you like and don't like about them?
Yeah, this is a cool question because the two fields are really different from each other. Academia is based a lot on theoretical, and a lot of time is spent just kind of exploring ideas by yourself. Industry, on the other hand, is much more application-based, and it moves much faster because you have to test out MVP, roll it out, and iterate. And you cannot spend months theorizing on how it may happen. So it's a very different route. One thing I really did like in research and academia is how much more freedom and time you had, since you were not as pressed to be like rolling things to production. So you could really go down a lot of niche areas and come up with really cool solutions and ideas of yourself. So there's a lot of creativity and freedom offered, but at the same time, it was never really productionized. So I never got to see the day of light to users. And the code that was also written was usually more for one-off scripts and less from the lens of supporting a scalable production system. In industry, you get to use the kind of work and research that comes from academia, and you get to ship to production like right away. And end users also see the benefit right away. Your code also has to be much more elegant. It has to be scalable and maintainable, which I have actually enjoyed. I definitely see software as an art, and there's a lot of beautiful approaches and elegant ways to make it very lovely. But it does come at a cost of being able to really sit with your data and explore it, because there is much more pressure to be like churning things out to users. Companies are usually hiring you for a problem that they want to solve, and you're kind of there to kind of help equip them. So there's more pressure to be constantly churning work. And you're also usually working in like sprints or cycles. So your time is also divided up, and you have like less of an ability on how you want to spend your time, and a little bit less creative and free. So they both have pros and cons. Industry is much more fast paced, and you get to ship right to users. Academia, you get to like sit really, sink yourself really deeply into one or two ideas and explore as much as you want, but it doesn't really get to see the benefit of end users and get that iterative feedback right away.
Awesome, that's super cool. So going into some of your experience in research, I saw that you worked as a computer vision research intern for Infosys in India. How did you end up switching from statistics to computer visions? Because I know that you initially went into Infosys for statistics, and what kind of difficulties did you run into during that transition?
Yeah, really good question. So I came in with a statistics project, but I realized I was really getting pigeonholed into someone with a really strong profile in statistics. I wanted to kind of expand my breadth before I expanded my depth. And computer vision was something I had never done before, but it looked so cool to be able to like identify objects from images using machine learning. Like that just sounded so cool. And I'd never had the opportunity to do that. So there was that support at Infosys that I could switch over. There was a huge learning curve though, because I did not know anything about computer vision. All I knew was that it was pretty cool. So I had to learn all about like image segmentation and object detection and different algorithms and neural networks, all these like technical jargon that I'd never seen before. But there are so many resources online that it's actually pretty easy to be able to filter out and figure out what you really need to know. So by the end, I was able to make a working model of like an object detection for raccoons. The only reason it was raccoons was that I didn't have enough time to manually label my own data set. And the only data set that had like images labeled with bounding boxes on objects were raccoons online. So I was able to identify whether a video had raccoons or not and where it was and like what probability. So it was a really cool project, but definitely a big learning curve coming in from a more statistics background. I had to get more comfortable with the mathematics and your neural networks and the actual like TensorFlow logic. But it was pretty cool to be able to explore different kinds of paths and careers in the data space.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And just as a follow-up question, how was working in India? Do you have any cool stories from your experience there?
Yeah, it was a lot more fun than I had imagined. It was a total of 100 different interns around the world. And there was like onboarding every 2 weeks. So in my cohort, there were 20 people. So we got close really fast, and I'm still in touch with them. So every weekend we would go on a sleeper bus to go to like neighboring cities. And the sleeper bus was my favorite part because it was literally almost like a party bus, because it was all like 20 of us and no one could really sleep in the sleeper bus because it just was like so bumpy. And it was just like a very big hoot. So that was my favorite part. And also Thailand was so close by, and I had never imagined that I would be able to go to Thailand so early on, but I thought to use that opportunity. So I was actually able to take a solo trip to Thailand one of the weekends too, which also was not something I expected. So a lot of great travel opportunities and a lot of cool bonding opportunities with all the interns from like all around the world. So it was definitely a very memorable experience, one of the best like 10 weeks thus far.
Yeah, that sounds like a super cool experience. And so shifting to a more general aspect, so what kind of aspects of being a ML engineer do you enjoy the most? What kind of perks do you see it having over a sort of typical software engineer role?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really like the end-to-end responsibility. It's not a siloed role at all because it's at the intersection of so many disciplines. So each week is vastly different from the week before. So I have a lot of insight on what's happening from the data to the software side. And being able to own a product end to end is a really rewarding feeling. It also keeps my work pretty interesting. Whenever I spend too much time doing software engineering, I can pivot and do more machine learning AI work. And kind of like what I mentioned, there's from a practical standpoint, there's a lot of job security because I get to stay working on data engineering, data science, and software engineering skills. So there's a lot of things that I really enjoy about ML. Sometimes it can feel more like a challenge than a reward because you really are like jack of all trades, master of none. But I have found it more rewarding than challenging to be able to play with so many end-to-end tools.
Yeah, it's really insightful. Thank you. And this can be during your time from college and in the industry, but what has been the most enjoyable project that you have worked on?
Nice. I definitely enjoy the recommendation system in industry, but my time in academia when I was doing the data science research internship, I think was equally as exciting. It was also my first time working on data science by myself. I was super stoked to have landed a gig with the NIH, but I was also really afraid because I was told I'd be doing text mining and I had no idea what that meant. And I was really terrified to actually start working, but slowly I did teach myself text mining and how to parse a lot of data and how to kind of build ideas by myself. I got to a point where I could run wild with a half-formed idea and build it into something usable. And I was working with like clinicians and doctors and scientists and researchers. And it was the first time really working cross-functionally and understanding the needs of each discipline, as well as learning how to communicate a level that everyone understands. And in the end, I was able to like spearhead like 3 websites full stack by myself that like reduced analysis times from hours to minutes. But what was really important for me was that this was like the turning point in my career where I actually became confident in my own abilities of thinking about data and actually helping to productionize it. So it was a pretty pivotal point of my career, and everything that has happened since then has really come from my ability to just trust in myself.
Yeah, that project sounds super cool. So, and yeah, that wraps it up for your questions about your professional life. And so our next segment is going to be about the future of representation in AI. So for that, I'll pass it on to Matt.
Awesome. So this is our next section, future on representation in AI. And I know you already mentioned a few sections ago about the need for like diversity in AI, especially as we move forward with so many different applications that affect a lot of people. So my first question is, as a leader at your company now, how important is it to form diverse engineering teams?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think diversity across all industries are important in general, but I think especially in tech because it's changing the landscape of how we live and work rapidly. So we do need all hands on deck to help orient it in a direction that is meaningful, positive, and productive. So since tech is really becoming a larger part of our lives, it's really useful. It's necessary to make it a useful integration. So having as many diverse minds on deck to like attack problems from all different angles is really important so that we can have those different viewpoints and we can pressure test it from different angles at the pace that tech is moving. We can already see like some negative effects of tech, but we can counteract it if we can get ahead of it by having more tools in our arsenal. And it also helps a company stay very resilient. So if you only hire one type of person, for instance, you only get one type of problem solver, and that does not really generalize well to a wide variety of problems that you might face. So diverse teams are much more resilient to external influences or changes. I also think that diversity is really important for society. So instead of tech leaders optimizing for like engagement, they can also optimize for like mental well-being. Like I imagine like if big tech leaders were much more empathetic, how that could help transform our lives. So if it's in the right hands, who led by leaders who actually care about users and not the bottom line, I think it can be really transformative. And I don't think diversity is optional any longer if you do want to build a long-lasting and resilient company. People hold a wealth of knowledge. We're all like walking like Googles, and it's a huge untapped potential. if you have different sources, so you can tap into people from vastly different experiences and perspectives and bring you so much more knowledge to leverage with. And one important thing to notice is that diversity does not mean lowering the hiring bar. I think people kind of think that those two go hand in hand. It's being able to recruit, source, support, retain people from different backgrounds at the skill level you want. And diversity also extends beyond race and gender. It's also different personality types, different backgrounds, ages, disabilities, upbringings, viewpoints. It's a lot of different hemispheres. And when you work with a diverse group of people, you find out that different people can bring out different parts of you that help you grow in ways you wouldn't have known otherwise. So we each have like different strengths and weaknesses that we can complement for different viewpoints. And then having that kind of diversity on your team really lets you feel more supportive to be the best you are, and you feel much more empowered to share different kind of viewpoints. If you're constrained to like a very prescribed status quo of your team, you're much less willing to share different kind of ideas that can help everyone grow. So the more different viewpoints you have, the more you're able to kind of elevate your entire culture and bring the best version of everyone. And you can immediately see like the impact of diversity. If you go to a space with diversity and one without, you'll see the difference in energy. Like immediately, one is a bit more flat, a bit more uninspiring and dull, whereas the other is really lively and dynamic, where you're bouncing off very different ideas and perspective. And it's just a much better place to work if you're supported by like all modes of people and all thinking, not just like one or two types of people. So I think like the biggest takeaway is that anyone who wants to join AI really can join AI. Like it should not be gate kept from anyone. The more types of people we have, the better, but it's really an open field for anyone who wants to join.
Awesome. Honestly, like, wow, that's a really good answer. I like how you pushed it from so many different angles on that question. So I really appreciate that answer.
Yeah, for sure.
Then kind of like backing off of that, it's like kind of another loaded question. It's kind of wide open as well. What are like some ways that you think we can improve diversity in tech? You know, like you already mentioned some ways like retention in a company, which I didn't even think about, but like also like maybe at different levels, you know, within academia or like maybe even like grade school or even college levels.
Well, those are really interesting questions. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of solutions that can happen, both from the viewpoints of like industry leaders as well as minorities, as well as non-minorities. One thing that is important to realize is that it's much harder to change something once it's already been established. So you kind of have to be really intentional about it and build something for the future and not just like meeting the current needs and being really intentional about it. It's kind of similar to like any kind of infrastructure or company as they scale up. It's kind of an irreversible action. So you kind of have to prioritize it from the beginning if you really want to. One question I would want leaders to ask themselves is why they want to prioritize diversity, and if it's just going to be lip service, because it's not a one-time effort. It does require continuous effort, and it's not just a bandage that can solve a lot of problems. Like for instance, if a team is starting up, you have to be really intentional about each hire and how it scales. If all of your founding members are all white males, it's very unlikely that you're going to end up with a diverse workplace as you scale up. Minority people typically do not want to be guinea pigs, and it's going to be much more difficult convincing a woman of color to join a team when they don't feel visibly seen or heard, and it's a much larger uphill mountain. So before I even like share advice, it has to come from a place of like proper intention and knowing that this is something that's going to scale for the future. So it has to be intentional from a lot of different places, from like sourcing, retaining, and supporting the work is not done. So when I was applying for jobs, I saw all the ways in which the industry pipeline was broken for minorities, from job posts to hiring to interviews to the interview panel to the team makeup. So I'll kind of share like some of my thoughts that I found. So many of the job posts that I saw would have a lot of quantifiable numbers, like we're looking for a rock star person with 4 years of experience on this or 2 years of experience of this. It's been shown that women will only apply for jobs when they match nearly all of the qualifications. So you're already reducing the types of people applying for your job if you don't make it, if you make it so gate kept like that. So being intentional with the way you post your job and making sure that it's getting the proper response from all sides. And then hiring also is something that's been difficult. So in software engineering and ML, many companies will do like leak code preparation or take home tests. I talked to a lot of females and they found that it's unfair for them to be expected to do unpaid preparation, whether it's take home tests or leak code preparation. And I see a huge dip in interest from females when they have to spend time outside of work to do that, because it's time that they can't afford and they're already busy managing other parts of their lives that males might not have to worry so much about. So being intentional about the hiring and making sure that it's a level playing field for that. To interview, so suppose a woman does get through the loops of applying to a job to being able to pass the leak code or take home test, the interview should also be reflective of what you're kind of looking for. So many of the interviews, they are looking for like one type of thinker. Can this rock star solve like this unforeseen problem optimally in 30 minutes? Some of that does not translate very well to industry actual practices. I know that I'm a very strong software engineer, but I also know that I write my code very intentionally with a lot of thought and research before opening a pull request. I don't do something in 30 minutes and just ship it and ask for feedback. So there's some kind of practices that might need to be like rechecked to make sure that's being more reflective of actual capabilities. Interview panel, of course, is something that's really important too. I've been in interviews where 20 of my interviews in a row were all males, and that's definitely not a coincidence. So if you have an interview panel, make sure that it is diverse and the person you're interviewing can also feel seen and heard. It's a two-way interview. It's not just you trying to source capable candidates. And then to the actual team makeup. So if they are able to pass through all the loops through the interview panel and they're actually on a team, most likely they will be like one of few minority people. Really being able to support and amplify their voices and knowing that they have as much to contribute as anyone else and not make them feel like unsupported is super important. So being able to support them and retain them is really important. So that's like on the industry company side. As employees though, like what can we do? Because a lot of these changes take time for industries to actually adapt. I think for minorities, we have to speak up and call out bad practices. It is kind of frustrating for like the burden to fall on minorities, but we can't expect to be helped if we don't share what is frustrating us. And actually we might be surprised how many times we might be met with empathetic ears. I had interviewed with a FANG company and all of the interview panel was male. And I reached out to my recruiter later and shared that it kind of made me feel less visible and made me question whether I would also belong. And they took that feedback really well and implemented it in the next cycle. So I think it's something that can be heard well with empathetic ears if you are a minority. So you do have to call it out. And the burden does unfortunately fall on us, but it's important to call it out and you will be surprised to see how much empathy you are met with. As people who are non-minorities, we really do need to have like each other's back and really be able to like amplify any comments or suggestions or concerns that people are alluding to. Also giving credit where it's due. Many times minorities might not be able to promote themselves out of fear of looking too arrogant or too like bossy. So really being able to give credit where it's due. Also being a safe space where others can confide in you. So it's really in the best interest of all of us to have non-judgmental spaces, because we all are different outside of just race and gender. Like we have different hobbies, viewpoints, upbringings, personalities. So like creating a similar space, just like you would create a similar safe space for maybe like quiet and introvert. So by like using like a lot of like inclusive, neutral language that like doesn't gatekeep anyone, and really checking yourself to make sure that you are letting everyone kind of come through. I think we have to just realize like when one of us is able to succeed, we all are able to succeed. So not really worrying about like competition and being much more collaborative. Like there's a lot of problem spaces and data and it keeps growing at like an exponential space. So there's no like worries of being threatened. So we just need to stay collaborative and like intentional and objective and like checking ourselves, whether our behaviors or words are like siloing people out. Are certain people not able to share their viewpoints? So kind of being really objective and intentional about it. So there's a lot of work that can be done from our side instead of kind of leaning in on the industry side as well. So those are kind of the thoughts that I've been thinking about as I've been kind of like talking to other people and reaching out to different types of companies.
Yeah, those are amazing thoughts. And you also organized it really eloquently. So I really appreciate that. And yeah, I like how you mentioned that there's a lot of improvements for like every actor in the situation, you know, minorities, mm-hmm. non-minorities, and also leaders as well. So I appreciate you taking all sides of the argument. So one last question for this section. What's your motivational message to students that are considering pursuing computer science or AI? You know, maybe they're struggling to get started, or like they don't know where to start. You know, what's kind of your motivational message to them?
Yeah, I think these are really hard topics in general. So being patient with yourself and know that like data, AI, ML, those fields are going to just grow. So it's okay to take time and grow into it. Object-oriented programming, machine learning, deep learning, these are pretty challenging topics and they're not meant to be easy. They're usually a culmination after you've built up your logical skill set, mathematical and statistical background. So you can't really rush it. And sometimes things don't click until multiple attempts. Like for me, I actually took AP Computer Science in eighth grade and I was so bad at it that I had to drop out my first semester and I took the APCS exam. I got a 1 on it. I took it again in high school. I also struggled through APCS. In college too, I understood it, but not to the extent that my peers did. It didn't really click totally with me until in industry. So it took me like at least 5 attempts to actually get it. With neural networks as well. There was a video series by 3Blue1Brown on neural networks. And I remember seeing that video series at 4 different points in my journey from college to industry. And each time it like made more sense eventually. So it's like a very slow process. So I would advise like starting with the basics, like start with linear regression or start with like understanding variables and for loops and if statements. Really grasp all that before you move on to like data structures or object-oriented programming or machine learning. So it's a very slow process and having to be patient with yourself is a really difficult thing, but data is going to be here for a long time. So you don't need to stress about that. I mean, you also don't need to worry too much about like the nitty-gritty details of every single like algorithm and technique or framework. You can Google these things and these things change very often too. So it's actually in your best interest to just understand the fundamentals before really diving deep into it. So one thing I really learned is just teaching myself like how to learn, because there are so many new frameworks and like sub problems and algorithms, you're never going to master it all. So it kind of, you kind of have to like reframe your thinking of thinking why you want to solve something instead of how, and you'll find that it's much more easier once you kind of think about like the why. I found like in machine learning, a lot of the problems are built upon neural networks. Like computer vision, natural language processing, recommendation, search systems, they all have very different implementations. But if you understand like the basics of neural networks, which only comes once you've mastered like logistic regression, which only comes after you've mastered like linear regression, you're able to expand that across very different fields. So it's something that takes time, but once you have the building blocks in place, a lot of different things will open up to you. So a lot of things in there, but just be patient with yourself, learn how to learn, and just don't really stress too much about your progress, because it is supposed to be a difficult journey. It took me like many, many attempts, like 5 times to really understand what I was even doing.
Awesome. I appreciate your testimony. It's to see how you've been patient throughout the many years and how, you know, now you're an ML engineer. So that's cool to see your journey.
Thank you.
So our last section, just some concluding questions, just 4 of them. So I'll start off with the first one. What's your favorite hobby to do outside of work?
I really like hip hop dancing, which interestingly, I was really bad at growing up, but I loved music and I love the musicality of music. And I like to study like what makes dancers good dancers. So now I really love dancing. I usually like to spend a lot of my time outside of tech doing non-tech and just engaging like more creative parts of my brain, which I'm sure helps me in turn, but it's really nice to just kind of step away and just work on things that don't have like deadlines or pressure.
Nice, nice. And I know you just mentioned that you like focusing on non-tech stuff, but do you have any interesting side projects you have lined up or plan to do in the future?
Yeah, so I actually do want to be a more present voice in the tech space and like be a more strong advocate of like empathetic, kind, and authentic and like real approaches in machine learning software engineering, like help like dismantle gatekeeping systems. So you might see more of that of me soon in the sphere. So yes.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that too. Like just being more empathetic, especially in the tech space. So I really support that mission as well. Moving on to the last question. Can you please yell You belong in AI for those listening.
Yeah, for sure. You belong in AI.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of You Belong in AI. This episode was made possible by UCLA ACM AI Outreach. Again, my name is Matthew Ruiz, and I was co-hosted today by Brian Park, and our guest was Kitu Koma, a machine learning engineer at O'Reilly Media. This episode was edited by Matthew Ruiz, and the music is by Kevin McLeod, and it's called Cherry Monday.